It's simple. It's dumb. It's the podcast. Final episode of the season. Throughout the entire season, we've spoken with a lot of different people, longtime friends and collaborators, musicians who've been influenced by Jason's songwriting over the years. We've even spoken with Jason's very own dad. On this final episode of the season, we've got a lengthy discussion with someone who was right alongside Jason and Granddaddy. Today, we speak with Granddaddy's tour manager, Daryl Bascom. Now, you may be thinking, I don't know who Daryl Bascom is. Why would this even be interesting to me? Let me tell you, Daryl has some amazing stories and insights from his time on tour with Granddaddy that I don't believe have ever been shared publicly before. He's in the Granddaddy inner circle without a doubt. Plus, he had the extremely enviable position of being on the crew for the legendary Elliott Smith Granddaddy tour when they were touring in support of Figure Eight and The Software Slump, respectively. Two of the most iconic indie rock albums in the last, well, ever. Daryl had many different responsibilities that he'll talk about during the episode, but perhaps his most noticeable contribution to Granddaddy's live performances over the years, at least from the audience's perspective, was the visuals projected behind the band while on stage. And not exactly Granddaddy related, but did I mention that he was also tour manager for both The Flaming Lips and Pavement at times during the 90s? Daryl could probably write several books with all of the experiences he's logged. Now, the episode is longer than normal, but I refuse to apologize for that. There were just too many great anecdotes and sentiments that I couldn't decide what to edit out. So feel free to break it into a two-parter if that helps you get through it all. Anyways, let's go ahead and hear from Daryl, or D-Rel, as he was affectionately referred to by the band. Here it is, my conversation with Daryl Bascom. How did you get started going on tour with bands and working in this industry?
Well, I grew up in Oklahoma, and for some reason, the promoters there only did classic rock or country. And I had to drive to Dallas to see all the shows that I wanted to see. I got tired of driving to Dallas, and I knew these bands, all these great indie rock bands, were playing in Lawrence, Kansas, and they're driving right through I-35, right through Oklahoma, and going to play Dallas. I did a little research and looked at the show that actually sparked my interest, not only my interest, but really catapulted me into the business. In 1989, I drove to Dallas to see this 4AD band. I was really into all the 4AD artists, the Cocteau Twins. I went to see Wolfgang Press. And that night, opening for the Wolfgang Press was this Dallas band called Course of Empire. And I was so blown away by their show. Had no idea who they were or what they were about or where they were from or anything, but I was just so intrigued. Their live shows were so amazing. Went up to the lead singer, to the merch booth afterwards, and had conversations, and I was just enamored with the whole thing. And I said, my friends back home have to see you. I have to bring you back to Oklahoma. They're like, all right, let's do it. And that started me into the indie rock showbiz. And I started putting on shows. A short time after that, that band, Course of Empire, got signed with a major label, Zoo BMG. And things started taking off for them. And they needed a tour manager. And I had some bonding time with those guys, and they said, hey, we want the lead singer called me up one day and said, hey, we're going on tour. We need a tour manager. I was like, yeah. So he's like, we want you to be our tour manager. I was like, I don't know the first thing about being a tour manager. I was a little excited, but just intimidated by the whole thing. And he said, come on, you're going with us. And he said, I'll show you the way. And that was the beginning of my trek. Tour managing, like with anything else, any other business in the world, how you get gigs from one to another is just networking. So my trek started with Course of Empire. It was phenomenal. I loved living like a gypsy. That started another tour with a band from California in the Fresno area called the Miss Allens, because they were on the same label, Zoo BMG, one of the A&R peoples. You know, I got off tour with Course of Empire, and they said, hey, we have another one of our baby bands up and coming. We want you to go on tour with. Like, okay, sure. When do I leave? And just one thing leads to another. Back then, putting on shows back in Oklahoma, I was putting on the Flaming Lips shows back in Oklahoma City and Norman area. Things started rolling with them. They did their own tour managing back then, the early 90s. Michael Ivins, a bass player, was their tour manager. But they got signed to Warner Brothers, and things started taking off. And I got a call one day, and they said, hey, why don't you go on the road with us? We need a tour manager. Things are getting a little bigger than they've been in the past. I was like, oh, my God. The Flaming Lips are asking me to go on tour with them. Okay, cool. When do I leave? Just one thing after another.
Yeah, the Flaming Lips are like one of the seminal bands in, as far as like live performances, I would have to think. I mean, that had to be mind-blowing for you to be invited to go on tour with them and have input on different things about their performance, right?
Yeah, what's not to like or love about that? I mean, join the carnival and you know, back then it was the earlier albums of Transmissions. This was, you know, the pre-Soft Bulletins, Transmissions from Satellite Heart, and some of the others. You know, we were just taking Christmas lights on tour. You know, we'd spend the day hanging 10,000 Christmas lights. This was before we started doing video backgrounds.
Mm. So what was your role on some of these tours? I mean, most people, including myself, don't have the faintest idea of what responsibilities a tour manager might have versus maybe like a booking agent or someone who's at the merch booth or whatever. So what's all fits in with its responsibilities?
Oh my gosh. At a band at this level, everything and other duties as assigned. From the corporate world, a tour manager, I'll throw out some titles that you're doing and taking care of on the road. You're the accountant. You're the manager of everything. Everything has to come back to you. You're the travel agent. You are the HR department. You're trying to make everybody get along and trying to negotiate everything. But it's crazy. So from the beginning, you know, getting the tour, you're scouting out the logistics of it. You know, you're finding out the travel, the lodging. You know, you're dealing with accounting, the cash flow, the merch. On big tours, these are separate positions. You have a tour manager, you have a production manager, you have a stage manager that's just tending to the stage, you have the production manager that's tending to the overall production, and then you have a tour manager that's dealing with more of the business aspect. But at these mid-level bands, like, you know, Flaming Lips or Granddaddy or Elliot Smith, you know, a lot of those roles are all tied into one. Those bands just don't have the budget, the money to have all those extra positions. And that's one thing I learned in the early days working with the Lips is the more jobs you can do and the more valuable you are to the more of an asset you are to a band or to a label.
Okay. So this is a Jason Lytle/Granddaddy podcast. So how did you get linked up with Granddaddy during this time?
All right. So that story's kind of funny. Somewhere about It may have been on the Music Against Brain Degeneration tour with the Flaming Lips and Sabado and Robin Hitchcock. We were riding in the, I remember distinctively riding in the van, and Coyne was driving and I'm in the passenger seat. And there's a conversation with Coyne and Droz about this band Granddaddy. And I was like, Granddaddy, what is Granddaddy? And what kind of a name is that? That sounds stupid. And Coyne was like, Bascom, you need to check out Granddaddy. They're right up your alley. And I was, and he's kind of said it in kind of a derogatory, snide way. So I was like, I kind of had a screw you, Wayne Coyne attitude. You don't know me. What do you mean? You know I would like it. It's right up my alley. So I, for the longest time, kind of just brushed off Granddaddy, and I never went and followed up on it. One thing led to another on the networking side of things, and Elliot Smith Management Company got a hold of me, reached out to me. Turns out he wanted the guy from the Flaming Lips to go on tour and do his lighting and video for the Figure Eight tour. I was just so blown away. Of course, I dropped everything and I prepped for tour and worked with Elliot's management company and Elliot to what that, you know, what they wanted to see and what their vision was for the Figure Eight tour. And lo and behold, come to find out, I get on the pathway to the pre-planning the tour, and I find out that the opening band is Granddaddy. I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to find out what this Granddaddy thing is all about. And I honestly missed the early days of Granddaddy because I felt like I had out to prove Coyne wrong that Granddaddy maybe wasn't my cup of tea. And then I really honestly didn't listen to Granddaddy until that first night of the Elliot Smith tour and they opened. And I was blown away. I was a little, sorry, a little nostalgic. It's a relationship, you know. It was kind of like love at first sight. I don't want to be cornball here, but it was kind of love at first sight. They were freaking amazing from top to bottom, everything. Of course, I've met them at load in and during the day and set up and, you know, got to know them during the day that first day, but I had no idea what I was about to encounter. They were just so sweet and endearing and just so down to earth, you know. They were just so non rock starish whatsoever. And then, you know, it was first day of tour, so they didn't get much of a sound check, so I didn't get to hear much of them until they came on stage, and then they were just so amazing. And the songs and the stories, and it was just love at first sight. So Elliot Smith was my introduction to Granddaddy, and that tour is kind of, you know, kind of legendary in our camp.
I would think it'd be legendary in a lot of camps. I mean, Figure Eight and Software Slump together,
all kind of combined into one. It's hard to even articulate the feelings and the emotions and what it was like to be a part of that. And we were just so unaware at the time, you know, when you're in the moment, you had no idea what you were, how legendary that moment was, you know. We were all just living and just partying and having fun, and everybody was just doing what they loved to do at the time. Amazing, amazing time. Both of those bands. Elliot and I ended up jumping ship a lot of times and just riding the Granddaddy bus. There was just a friendship and a camaraderie that is just hard to describe. Just a love for each other and respect and admiration for each other's music. Both bands on both sides of the track, everybody just at a level playing field, and there was just so much love and camaraderie. It was so cool.
There's the podcast, My Favorite Elliot Smith Song, in which both Jason and Jim had their own episodes as guests on that podcast. And they were talking a lot about this tour and some of the stories and the relationships that came out of that. And I think it aligns very well with the way that you're describing it, and that it was really like a true friendship that, I remember there was the one story that I loved about how they were just, they would bring furniture out into like some hotel courtyard and just play music in the evening and cook out and stuff like that. It sounded amazing.
Everywhere we went, it was like that. It was like we set up a hobo camp everywhere we went, drug our charcoal, or the granddaddy guys always had a charcoaler with them. Whether it's stuck at a venue and we just brought out our lawn chairs, or whether you're stuck at the hotel. That's the drag about once you make it to the bus level of tours, you're just kind of trapped to wherever that driver stops, whether it's at the hotel or the venue. But yes, those parties that they describe were legendary. Full on, not just the chairs out of the rooms, but the lamps. They bring the whole hotel room furniture to poolside. There's a time or two we had some heated conversations with hotel managers. But
so is there a memorable show during that stretch, or do they all just kind of run together as a total experience? I'm just curious if you have any of those moments that you can get almost like transported back to one particular show or one particular moment within a show that really stood out from that tour specifically.
Gosh, it would be hard to just pinpoint one of them.
Yeah.
You know, the Wiltern, the theater, the last night of the tour was pretty magical.
Was that the one where Elliot gets up on stage with them and sings He's Simple, He's Dumb?
Yeah. Yeah. They come back out on stage with Elliot and do Don't Fear the Reaper, the Blue Oyster Cult cover. Just some amazing, amazing legendary rock shows in that era.
So let's talk a bit more about Elliot Smith and what he was like on tour, your interactions with him, as well as maybe any interactions that Jason or the band had with him that you had an insight into.
Yeah, I wasn't the tour manager on that tour. So Elliot brought me on just to do, I was the lighting director and video projectionist, if you will. So I just got to sit back rather than doing all the business and the accounting and the hotels and the travel. I got to sit back and have a little bit more of an artistic flair, if you will, and mixing live cameras. And we had little lipstick cameras around stage and could get Elliot's hand motions, you know, whether it's keyboards, they were playing, or strumming of guitars. You know, we could mix with the other layered video components that were being played as well. So I had the ability to have a little bit more laid back than being the tour manager on some of the other tours. I can't tell you the amount of nights Elliot and I were the last ones up on the bus, and everybody just crashed and just either, you know, from the long day or just passed out from drinking. But I can tell you how many nights that I was the last one up on the bus, and Elliot would turn to me and just say, "Hey, Daryl, would you mind staying up a little longer? I'm not ready to go to bed." You know, how would you tell Elliot Smith? No, dude, I'm good. I'm tired. I'm gonna go ahead and turn in. So there was never a time that I didn't just stay up. I do remember a time I probably just passed out on the couch, just staying up with him, but staying up, listening to music or just talking about just everyday life stuff. You know, obviously cherish those memories. And sorry, had no idea, you know, at the time that things would end up the way they did. So, obviously cherish those times. I had no idea in the moment, you know, that I would never have those type of times and see Elliot again.
Skipping ahead, you know, many years now, I know that Jason had been invited by, I think it was called the Color Bars Experience in France, to perform some of Elliot Smith's songs from Figure Eight. And yeah, he did this along with Troy Von Balthazar and Ken Stringfellow. Question is, would Mama be proud? There's a silver lining in the corporate cloud, and the pretty post that you're taking as an NCO. What was your reaction to seeing that, especially maybe the impression that you feel like it might have had on Jason himself to put himself out there like that?
Yeah, wow. It was hard to watch, honestly. If you know Jason personally, you can see how hard it is for him. If you're watching those videos, I was not fortunate enough to go to France for those shows, and gosh, I don't know if I could have made it through them, because I'm kind of a wimp. Wish I knew what you would do. Why you'd want to do it this way, so I can't go the distance. I got a long way to go and getting further away. I've got a long way to go and getting further. But you, if you know Jason personally, and just probably from being entrenched in that camp on the Figure Eight tour, and saw how close that Jason was with Elliot, you can see how hard it is for Jason to even get through some of those songs watching those videos. But I know that it meant the world to him. I stay in contact with Jason. He told me about it at the time that he was going to do that. He was very ecstatic, but also emotionally torn. Man, you can, maybe it's just me because I know him personally. You can, or I think anybody could see it. He almost gets choked up at a couple of places in those songs. It's, and I think he even talks about it at one of the intros, or maybe it's like the last song on that video. And he talks about how overwhelming the whole experience has been for him. I picked up the song and found my picture in the paper. The reflection in the water showed an Iron Man still trying to salute people from a time when he was everything he's supposed to be. Everything means nothing to me. 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 Everything means Elliott's music is soul-stirring enough as it is. But just to have that experience and then combine the two, it was overwhelming for me to watch as an audience member, let alone I can't imagine or fathom what Jason was going through in the moment, trying to get through that stuff.
Yeah. One more thing that just popped into my head. And I don't know if you were on the tour that Granddaddy did with Pete Yorn. Were you on that tour as well?
No.
Okay.
Thankfully I was not. I did do the Coldplay tour.
Talk about that for a second. You have to tell us a story or two about that. Cause I honestly don't know much about that tour, but whenever I hear about it, I'm like, how did those two bands, I mean, obviously it had to be something with regards to record labels, I imagine, but.
Yeah, it was right. It seemed to be right when Yellow had just taken off and Coldplay was going to be the next big thing, or they were the next big thing. And, you know, so, you know, again, Granddaddy in that time period felt like they're spinning the wheels. They sucked it up and are going to go be the opening act just to get that much more exposure. And man, all of the band members in Coldplay are total sweethearts and very down to earth. But Chris Martin, my Lord, I have never been around such a narcissist. The guy, I'm a little bitter because I was, you know, I like to stick up for my guys. We went through that whole month of that Coldplay tour and Chris Martin screwed us out of a sound check every day. We've closed out that tour, that Coldplay tour at Radio City Music Hall in New York City. I and the guys were just so frustrated and just so kind of burnt out and tired of this grueling tour opening up with Coldplay every night, who it just didn't even allow for the guys to even get a sound check. I mean, we were loading on stage and the doors were already open every night. And so I going back to the final show in these big theater business, there's this thing called a dark stage before the doors open. When a theater is getting their house ready, there goes to a dark stage. It's in a union house. Well, you have the ability as the artist to purchase that dark stage. I think it cost, I don't know, $1,500 to pay the union to keep their stagehands on and buy out that dark stage. Well, by God, I knew in advance that Coldplay was going to screw us out of our sound check for the guys' big opportunity to play at Radio City Music Hall. I got with a label. I thought I was forward thinking. I got with the record label and said, hey, I want to buy out the dark stage. I want Granddaddy to have a sound check. And this was, I think, of the era when he was dating Gwyneth Paltrow. And Chris Martin decided not to show up for his own sound check that afternoon and ran right up to the dark stage. And when he did come in, he noticed that his whole stage setup was off-centered 2 feet to the right and made his whole production crew move the whole band back line 2 feet to the left so it would be on center with his view. And they went into their sound check and lo and behold, I go walking backstage and the union steward hands me back my check that the label gave us and said, here's your check back. Coldplay bought out the dark stage so they could extend their sound check. They're the headlining artists, so they have first right. And we lost our sound check at Radio City Music Hall. And it was just one more kick in the gut. You know, and without a proper sound check on those big tours like that, when you're setting up the PA, it's not like you're walking into a club and the sound system is all dialed in. You're loading a sound system into a truck and off to a truck every day. You need a sound check. You need to get everything ironed out. And Granddaddy, as you know, has a lot going on stage. There's a lot of inputs and there's a lot of things to figure out. You don't just set up and go. But that's what we were forced to do every day on the Coldplay tour. And it was kind of grueling, you know, because so you're defeating the purpose. You took on this tour that you're not really thrilled about it, but you would agree to do in order to get some great exposure. But then you're screwed out of your sound check every day. it was just grueling to watch. So I just kind of, it just really made me despise Chris Martin. It was shows and tours like that that gave Jason Lytle a screw you attitude. And he just got to a point where he just didn't give a fuck.
You've been on the road with Granddaddy really multiple times, I think, not just on that Software Slump tour, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So what are some of the challenges? What's different about touring with Granddaddy as compared to maybe the Flaming Lips or some of the other bands? What makes them different from some of the other bands that you've worked with in the past?
Man, that's a tough question. They obviously have a brotherhood like nobody else.
Really? Wow. The
common love and respect for each other. I was just so blessed to be allowed into their camp. And when they invited me in, they just, with open arms, invited me in. I wasn't just a worker. I wasn't just a paid staffer. That is one thing that they allowed me that no other band has allowed me, is creative ability to bring to the table. You know, at first I was just playing whatever they had worked on and come up with on video backgrounds. And then we started blending and working together on ideas and songs. And hey, what about this for this video background for this song? And it was just like, they allowed me access like nobody else has, just to be part of one of their creative partners in that regard. And then by the time we did, you know, did 2012, those reunion gigs, they were like, Daryl, just do your deal. We don't even want to even be weighed down with the conversation of it. Let's just go and have a good time. You've got this type thing, you know, and just allowed me just to run with it. So it was so great. I felt like I was 100% led into their brotherhood from the first time that I was invited to go on tour. And I went and the first place I stayed in Modesto was at Kevin Garcia's house, at his parents' house. It's where we prepped video for the first tour I ever toured with them. You know, they didn't fly me in and stick me in some hotel. I was just like family with them. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty blessed in retrospect.
Yeah.
But that's how those guys are though, too. They didn't want to just hire hired hands. They were very meticulous on when they hired their sound engineers, their monitor engineers, or myself. That touring life, as glamorous as it sounds, is really freaking hard. And I think you've heard that through Jason's stories and Jim's stories. It's not as glamorous as it seems.
Let's talk about that. What were some of the challenges of being on the road with Granddaddy? Or really with anybody, but I guess if you could relate it back to Granddaddy, that would be interesting as well.
Yeah, it's just in general, you're living Groundhog Day every day. So let's go out and put on a rock show. Mm-hmm. So you start in the morning, you find out what time doors are going to be, and you got to work backwards out of that to set up, to find out when you're going to start setting up, load in, and what all the bells and whistles we're going to try to pull off each day. It's a, you know, you try to find days and the time to even eat. Sometimes you're so busy on show days, you're not eating healthy. You don't have a standard life. It's really tough. But again, it's like Groundhog Day. You set up all day long. You work real hard. You get the doors open. Keep everything on time. You put on this great rock show. Then you drink, take pills, get high, whatever it takes to come back down off of that high from the rock show, so that you can go to sleep, so that you can drive overnight, so you can get there the next morning, so that you can be there in time to set it all up again and put on this big show. It's just Groundhog Day, and you're repeating itself over and over and over. You know, not to mention all the little idiocracies that come along with it. You've heard Jason talk about is that stupid self-promotion that he has to do every day is part of it. Every city, he has to talk about himself and brag about himself. And it'll just suck the life out of you day after day after day. And you're living either in a van or a bus, cooped up in this little tin can with the same 10, 12 people for days on end, you will either grow to love them or hate them.
You know, he said at one point, like, if we go out on tour again, somebody's going to die. Like,
yeah.
And I don't know if he was joking, really, you know, like, I don't know if, like, I think he was being serious that, like, it was, touring was not healthy for him or for anybody at that point.
Having been on tour with Jason, back in some of those early days, it's amazing that nobody died back in the day. We did stupid shit. You do stupid things when you're under the influence of drugs and alcohol. We just thought we were invincible back then. And we had such an attitude of we don't give a fuck attitude. I remember one night we went off in Columbus, Ohio. Jason and I went off after a show with another local who wanted to take us to some after parties. And we were just walking through neighborhoods in the middle of nowhere. And of course, Columbus, Ohio, that's right there on the college campus. There's a lot of student housing and fraternity houses and sorority houses. And I won't go through the list of drugs that we had taken that night or the list of alcohol and drugs and everything we were under, but we just did stupid things. I remember after hitting some house parties that we were walking back towards the bus and walked past this fraternity house. And this is probably 2 or 3 in the morning, and a bunch of frat guys out all over their deck on their patio. And Jason, I don't remember if it was Jason or myself, but we would just dare each other, just do stupid shit. Hey, watch this. And, you know, one of those, hey, hold my beer, picks up the water sprinkler that they had on at 2 in the morning and went up and hosed down the frat boys that were hanging out, drinking, partying on their front porch, on their own turf. I mean, these guys were so, and I mean, you know how big, Jason's not a very big guy. He's pretty wiry. He could take me. I'm not a very big guy. I'm pretty lanky. Seriously, we should have died that night. I thought those guys were going to kill us. They came up over that porch and chased out in the yard. Luckily, the local that we were with, this guy was about 350 pounds. He was huge. He was kind of a bigwig in the local drug community, I'm pretty sure. I think I knew him from several tours. He jumped in front of the fraternity boys and in between Jason and I and the frat boys and kind of talked them off of a ledge. And kind of saved us from getting our asses kicked that night. And we just walked on down the street laughing about it. We just no fear. I don't know if that's a California skateboard thing or what. There are hundreds of those type of stories. So when Jason says, if we go on tour again, somebody's going to die. I mean, it's not too far-fetched.
Yeah. Or at least it wasn't then, right? Now it would probably be a bit different.
Now it would be totally different, you know. You know, tragedy changes you.
Yeah.
Granddaddy will never be the same without Kevin.
Yeah. You know? Feel like Kevin was probably like the social glue of the band. Is that an accurate description, perhaps?
Yeah. He was always the calm and the cool and the collective. Yeah, he never got worked up.
Yeah.
I mean, unlike myself or Jim, we would kind of be reactionary. Kevin was the calm.
Yeah.
With everyone and everywhere we went. Yep.
What else took place on tour that really showed kind of how fun it was for you and the guys in Granddaddy that maybe some outsiders would find surprising?
Yeah. Well, I don't know about surprising or not. Well, I guess if you kind of are Granddaddy fans, you wouldn't see them as being into dance parties at all. But one of the great things that happened on the Figure Eight tour is that after the show, you know, both bands, everybody's so jazzed. No one goes to bed when you're that jazzed and that pumped after that kind of show. So we would actually set up color changing and moving lights in the back of the bus. You know, those buses, those tour buses aren't very big, but we were up on the couches and the seats, and we had disco balls and moving lights and just dance parties with Dr. Octagon and all kinds of crazy twisted music. We just had a blast on that tour.
And that's just driving around from city to city. Y'all would be doing this on the bus, right?
Well, yeah. There's this, you know, in the touring business, you see the buses outside the venue. Well, typically we as the band or crew are stuck there after the show, because what happens is that you hire a bus and a driver, and the driver goes to the hotel for the day and the night. And then he has a plan to come back at 3 a.m. or whatever that is. So I mean, if you're done with a concert at 12 midnight, you know, you've got 2 or 3 hours to waste. So we got a lot of time on our hands, you know, after shows, once you're packed up. And so, gosh, what else is there? Drinking and drugging and dancing and having fun. You know? So it was just great. The camaraderie that happened between the Elliot Smith entire band, not just Elliot, but his whole band. He had just incredible musicians on that Figure Eight tour. And as well with the Granddaddy folks, everybody just had, I've never been on a tour where the chemistry was like that, where everybody was equals. The playing field was equals. You know, a lot of times in touring, you know, I've told my story about Coldplay, and there's this hierarchy, rock and roll hierarchy that happens a lot. And there's not always a level playing field, but you could see so well amongst not just Jason Lytle and Elliot Smith, but the actual musicians in each of those bands too, just the love and admiration that everyone had for each other. It was just an equal playing field, and we were just all friends and all on the same level. Doesn't happen a whole lot.
So Jason obviously is really into being outdoors, and maybe even you could say being by himself at times. Is that just difficult to come by on tour, or was he trying to find ways to slip off and try to enjoy what he could when he could?
Well, I think they did that and dabbled in that when they were in bands and van tours. But by the time Software Slump was, they were catapulted into a bus tour, and just to give up with the routes and the gigs are so far away. And when you're into the bus tour, it just doesn't allow for that to stop and do things outdoorsy, if you will. But we did carve out some time here and there. Like, I remember a time in New York City when we played Manhattan. Instead of staying in Manhattan and staying with that whole, you know, rock and roll theme and staying with the A&R people and the record label people after the show, we literally pre-planned to drive out to Woodstock and just to get out of New York City and just go be outdoors. So we found this old hotel motel in Woodstock, New York. And I remember, so we had a couple of days off afterwards. We could have stayed in New York City and just done the Manhattan thing. But of course, you know, the guys want to be outdoors. They won't be outside. Dr. Jason, Aaron, all of them want to be outdoors and live that lifestyle. So we remember setting up camp for a couple of days in this motel. It felt like almost an abandoned motel because you're in Woodstock, New York. Not a whole lot going on out there. So we kind of had the place to ourselves. The swimming pool was drained. I remember we had, you know, of course we have all our video gear. So we unloaded stuff off the bus and set up a theater in the inside of the dried out swimming pool, and brought out our lawn chairs and recliners and set up and watched movies. And so sometimes we would tie the technology with the outdoors and make the best of it. But as time went on, Jason started learning to negotiate outdoorsy things into his trips and from the get-go. One of my favorite things that he did for us is that reunion tour in 2012. That the promoter really wanted Granddaddy up in Norway, and Granddaddy were just going to go and do some, you know, big festival shows, do the big festival shows, you know, make some money, get out. But that Norway promoter would not take no for an answer, and they ended up negotiating them putting us up in this resort in this hillside Oceanside on the side of the hills inside of a mountain in this resort in Norway as part of the package deal to get them to play up there. So we were, gosh, had tons of days off. I can't remember how many days off were these people in Norway at this resort. Totally, they were enamored with Granddaddy. They totally took care of us like we were rock stars. It was unbelievable. They took us deep sea fishing. When we came back from deep sea fishing, they brought the ship close to the close to shore as they could, and then brought a little rowboat up to get us and take us out two by two up to shore to this cave where they did a cookout and dinner for us. In this cave on the side of the mountain, and they brought a battery powered turntable and a couple of crates of albums and let Jason DJ for us for dinner and cooked fresh fish and just had like a case of wine, and they just wined us and dined us like we were Oasis or something. It was crazy.
That's funny.
But again, you know, he started negotiating my outdoors into my touring. It's pretty smart.
Yeah. Otherwise, I imagine he just felt like he was a hostage on his own tour.
He did. Kind of. And, you know, you ask about some of the challenging things. Jason did have a, you know, back in the days of debauchery, there were times that Jason would just disappear. And we had interviews to pull off, and we had sound checks to do so the opening bands could do their sound checks, and Jason would just disappear. He just would, you know, needed a mental break, and everybody, mm-hmm. It would just cause a lot of stress and challenge for everybody else. You know, things are a domino effect.
So let's talk about the years after the Software Slump tour. I think you may have stepped away from the business. Maybe you want to talk about that a little bit.
2001, September 11th. I was living in New York City. I was working for Red Bull. I was in between tours, and I had taken a gig with Red Bull Music Academy. That's their DJ music academy that they put on in a different country every year. We were in New York City in Manhattan, and I was living there for August and September. And obviously, everybody, the world knows what happened September 11th. Mm-hmm. But leading up to that point, going touring with all these bands of the Lips and Granddaddy and dragging me around all over the world, going back and forth to Europe, I always had this weird phobia, and with in light of what was going on with Iraq and things around the world, I always had this weird phobia of World War III breaking out, and I was going to be trapped in Europe away from my family, my kids, and no way, you know, airports just be shut down and no way to get back to your own home country. And then I kind of lived that September 11th in New York City for a little while. No, there was no way to get in or out. And that was a pretty scary time for the entire world, but let alone if you were living in Manhattan at the time. There was tons of fear, not knowing what was going to happen. I said, you know what? I'm done. I am done. After this, I think Granddaddy was probably recording someday back then, mm-hmm. Prepping for the next thing. And I just said, I'm done. I went back home and got a gig at the University of Missouri, running their facilities, producing their concerts and things, and stayed in the Midwest where I felt a little more safe and where I could see my kids grow up. I would go on these tours for, you know, some were a month at a time, some were 3 months at a time. And it's just a grind. And in order to make money, you have to take the next tour and take the next tour. You never know the ebb and flow of the touring business and when your next gig is going to be. So you take all you can get. And I missed a lot of years of my eldest kids growing up. So I had to get off the road and quit living like that. Plus, I was turning into a drug addict and alcoholic like the people I was touring with. No, that's no slam to Granddaddy. That's every band. I mean, it's hard to be in that type of business and not drink and drug. As you've heard Jason Lytle talk about it himself, it's a miserable existence. At some point, even though you're with your best friends at times, it can be a very lonely place.
Yeah. We heard Jim talk about it too. And I mean, it sounds like everybody's in a much, much better place now, thankfully.
Oh my God. I'm so grateful they called me back up for those two reunion tours. I did the festivals in 2012 and again in 2016. And the guys are in such a better place. I'm in such a better place. I'm 8 years sober. And as you've heard Jim talk about it, he's sober. And I always get to catch up with Jim when he was touring with Modest Mouse. They come through Kansas City or St. Louis. We always get to hang out. So we've watched each other. And I still keep in contact with Aaron and Tim and Jason. And we're all in such a much better place. You know,
talk about those tours, because I spoke briefly with Jim about them, and it just seemed like everybody was really, I mean, and maybe it's just because it was more on social media than the early tours, right? But yeah. It seemed like everybody was having so much fun and really just relishing in all of the love from the fans and probably the love from each other as well.
Yeah, exactly. You know, back in the, I think even the Software Slump, Someday era. And for me, I'm sure it was for the guys. I'm just perplexed. How could they not be huge? You know, I didn't get it. Why yeah. is this not taking off? So and that's so frustrating. You know, the guys aren't making money. They don't seem to getting anywhere. They seem to be spinning their wheels. It's got to be so frustrating. So, you know, when the 2012 opportunity came along, and just to see the guys be in a better place, be in a better space, and be adored, you know, by the fans, and actually get paid what they deserved, and, you know, not doing stupid $1,000 guarantees here and there, and it was just so great. And then there wasn't all the debauchery as a result of drugs and alcohol, you know, back in the early days. Around mm-hmm. us, so we did all have fun. Everybody had a blast, and everybody cares about each other and cares about each other's families, and it was just so great to be together in that same group again, same sound engineer, same you know, myself, the guys, and not have those old early feelings of resentments or things that had transpired decade before just because of the rat race of the business. But to see everybody rejuvenated and everybody had gone on to be successful in their own right and just be able to share the love and adoration with each other again and waller in some nostalgia and, you know, play in front of 10,000 people in Europe. It's just, you know, it's a whole different level for Granddaddy in Europe than it is here in the States. That's for sure.
It is. It is. You know, one of my favorite moments of just following on social media was, I remember there was a clip where Jason was holding up his phone, filming the crowd in Tel Aviv. And I think y'all played three shows there back-to-back nights.
Yeah, I didn't get to do the Israel run. But yeah,
oh, you did. Okay.
I remember that though. Yep.
Yeah. It just looked like I just remember thinking like, wow, this many people in Israel love Granddaddy. That's amazing that they could do three shows that not only were they probably sold out, but their fans were just going crazy. It was nuts.
Yeah. I concur. That was pretty cool. I've never been there, so I had no idea that they would even know who Granddaddy were. Just as I tell Jason, I don't think Jason realizes how many people's lives that he's touched. I think he kind of has an idea, maybe in a small way, but I really think he has just touched so many people's lives with his music and his life stories and life lessons within his music.
Do you think he's comfortable with like acknowledging it, or do you think it kind of makes him uneasy?
Okay. I think it kind of makes him uneasy. I don't think he set out to be that.
Yeah.
I think he just wanted to play cool music and have a not be forced to a normal 9-to-5 job, pushing pencils. I don't think he probably had any idea that it would become what it is today.
I feel like we're so lucky and fortunate as listeners, though, that he's continued to make music and evolve over the years. I mean, there's probably plenty of times where he thought about hanging it up and walking away from music and doing something different.
Not only thinking about hanging it up, but he has hung it up and just freaking up and move states and just walk away from it and said, I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore.
Wow.
You know? Yeah. So we are lucky and blessed that he keeps stringing us along, so to speak. But he's an amazing visionary singer-songwriter, just legendary.
You still do obviously interact with Jason. I saw you at the February show in San Francisco in 19, the very first piano show. I think you had flown out there to do the video for that, right?
Yeah, was that the Noise Pop Festival?
Yeah. Yes, it was. Yeah. Yes, that's
Noise
right.
Pop. Yep. Yeah, that was back when he was being the visionary that he is and doing the piano album. He said he was going to do this one show, and yeah, we text and chat and keep in touch. And he thought he was going to add some video and hit me up and said, "Hey, do you have any interest?" Well, of course, my God, he has allowed me to. Still dabble in the business and come back in and out of the business. And plus just have so much love and adoration for Jason as a human, not just an artist. Flew out and he came out to the airport, picked me up and took me to dinner and back to his place, hung out for a couple of days and got to run through some rehearsal stuff at his place. And we got to play with some video gear and while he rehearsed for it. So that's always fun and interesting. And then, did that show in San Francisco.
Yeah.
It was like it never missed a beat.
Yeah. All right. So I've got one final question then before we get to, your favorite Jason Lytle song. But so did you ever go back to Wayne Coyne and tell him that he was right?
No, who wants to tell Wayne Coyne he's right? He's always right. He's got a big enough ego as it is, you know? He doesn't need one more person to say, hey, yeah, you were right. But that story has always stuck in my head. It's kind of funny.
It is a great story.
I think I've told Stephen Droz about it. But,
yeah.
But I haven't gone back to Coyne and say, yeah, you were right.
All right. Okay. All right, let's move to, I'll say one of your favorite Jason Lytle songs, because I'm getting the impression from each guest that it's too difficult to say with authority that it's their favorite. But do you have a favorite that we might talk about here?
Yeah, I will say it was really tough. And I follow your podcast. Obviously, I'm a Lytle fan, follow the podcast. So it's been really great to listen to all the different interpretations and inputs from Dad, from Ben, from Jim. It's been great to follow. But in an attempt to not repeat songs from one episode to another, man, that your previous guests have put me in a hard place. And then for weeks now, since your invitation, I've kind of just nothing but revisited the entire catalog of Granddaddy back and forth and back and forth. I kind of got stuck and the Family Cat, just like the Family Cat album, has a special place for me. It was kind of, you know, when I found out Granddaddy was going to break up, I was just devastated. It's like, no, things were just getting rolling. You can't break up. You can't stop now. I mean, and all the, you know, Granddaddy's music does for me is, you know, provide hope. You know, all the stories, Jason's life stories and life lessons that he talks about provides hope. I mean, yeah. And then for that, just to, you know, call it quits. It's just like, oh my gosh. It was just a timestamp for me in an era. So that album is really special to me. And that album is just so good. Just every single song, one after the other. So, in light of the my favorite Granddaddy song has already been used on a previous episode, my choice is going to be Rearview Mirror. That I've always had the luxury of when just before the albums would get released, Jason would send me a homemade copy of the albums, and I remember getting that album and listening to that album just cranked on 11 in my car, and the windows down and the sunroof back, and I just had visions of what that music video, what the background video was going to be for the live version of Rearview Mirror. So that kind of stuck with me. And so I've gone back and forth on what was going to be my favorite song, but I'm going with Rearview Mirror. One of the things I love about Granddaddy as a whole is just they give me variety. One thing that gets old with bands is I don't want a band that's just going to give me the same song for the whole album. You know, with Granddaddy, mm-hmm. I get the full broad spectrum, and you get that with Rearview Mirror. You know, it starts out with the slow, droney, swirling synthesizers, and you know, by the time it gets deep into the song, you get those really cool guitar tones, and meanwhile that steady acoustic rhythm guitar all the way through it, and then you know, by the time it gets to the end, you just rip your head off with that epic guitar solo.
That's the spot that Jason's commented in the past, that's like his walk off into the sunset moment, that guitar solo right there.
Exactly, it's just a mic drop when that guitar kicks in. Boom. It's just epic.
They never played that song live, did they?
No, I'm just getting ready to say, unfortunately, okay. I was never granted the opportunity to provide visual backgrounds for Granddaddy, for Rearview Mirror live.
Mm. You know, I mean, that goes back to that they didn't tour for that album at all.
Exactly.
And which is a shame, because I feel like that album would lend itself to a proper live concert so well.
Yeah.
All right, that brings us to the end of the episode. In fact, it brings us to the end of the season. Many thanks to Daryl Bascom for spending so much time with me and sharing so many amazing stories from behind the scenes. So, looking ahead, after a short break, I plan to begin work on some new episodes. Episodes that will be featured in Season 2 next year. I hope all of you enjoyed Season 1. I really enjoyed working on the podcast thus far, and the response has definitely exceeded my expectations. So thank you all for listening and for all the kind words you've reached out with. I also wanted to thank and publicly recognize the very talented Scott Arnold, who, as another big fan of Granddaddy and Jason's, offered to take on the artwork each episode. In fact, he's been more than just the artist because he's also been my sounding board in helping to identify potential guests and plan the discussions. Lastly, a very special thanks to Jason for, well, everything, obviously. Not just the inspiration for the podcast, but I'm obviously grateful that he's allowed me to use his songs in the podcast because it's not something that really would have worked otherwise. And despite not being associated with the podcast in any way, I'm glad he's allowed me to coordinate this directly with many who know him so well. Hopefully it didn't bring too much embarrassment along the way. Anyways, take care everybody. See you in 2022. I have no choice. I have no voice. I have no say. Choice, so I'll reach your